under the control of mob leaders.
Troon said even the Catholic Church does not take a forceful public stand against the mafias. He suggested Washington should ask the Vatican for greater cooperation. Under the heading, The Bridge to Organized Crime, the U.S. diplomat warned that the Berlusconi government's ambitious project to build a bridge linking Sicily to the mainland will benefit mostly the mafias at each end because of the large infrastructure investments that are needed. The consul had high praise for Roberto Saviano, author of a scathing expose of the Neapolitan mafia, the Camorra. Troon said Saviano is a valid role model for those willing to combat organized crime. Silvia Poggioli, NPR News.
And I'm Craig Windham, NPR News, in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Nissan, with the 100% electric, no-gas Nissan Leaf. Innovation for the planet, innovation for all. Details at nissanusa.com.
Programs on WILL are made possible by a grant from Champaign-Danville Overhead Doors, offering pinch-proof doors, keyless digital entries, and lifetime manufacturer's warranties. Champaign-Danville Overhead Doors, serving businesses and families with professionally installed doors and automatic openers since 1959 in Ogden, Illinois.
Hi, I'm Jim Meadows.
I'm Tom Rogers.
I'm Sean Powers.
And I'm Celeste Quinn. You listen to us on WILL Radio and TV, and now we want to listen to you. Every month, we're out in the community having conversations about your hopes and challenges. What we hear impacts the programs we produce. If you'd like to have a community conversation in your town, give us a call at 217-333-7300 or email willconnect@illinois.edu.
Good morning and welcome to Focus, our morning talk program. I'm David Inge. Today's first hour comes from the Focus Archives, so as you listen, keep in mind that we will not be taking calls.
When Theodore Roosevelt left the White House after two terms as president, he was only 50 years old. He had been the youngest person ever elected president of the United States. And the question that he had to confront was, what next? He did not slip into a quiet retirement. Instead, he went on a year-long African safari, and when he returned home, he plunged back into American politics. He ran for president, leading the most successful third-party effort to date. And many people feel if he had been the Republican nominee, he would have won. Many people also feel that had he not died in 1919, he well could have run again and would have been elected to a third term as president. This morning in this hour of Focus, we will explore the last 10 years in the life of our 26th president, and our guest is Edmund Morris. He has just published the third volume of a three-volume biography of Theodore Roosevelt. The first book, The Rise of Theodore Roosevelt, was about his life before the White House. That book won the Pulitzer Prize. The second, Theodore Rex, was about his time in the White House. And the book now we'll talk about today, Colonel Roosevelt, is about his last years, his last 10 years. It's published by Random House. It's just out. Edmund Morris also has written biographies of Ronald Reagan and also of Ludwig von Beethoven. And he's joining us this morning by telephone. And as we talk, questions certainly are welcome. We hope people will try to be brief. Try to stay on target with the topic, but certainly questions are welcome. Here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We have a toll-free line, good anywhere that you can hear us. That's 800-222-9455. You can also send along a question by email if you'd like, will-talk@illinois.edu. That is the address. And Mr. Morris, hello.
Good morning.
Thank you very much for talking with us. We appreciate it.
I do, too.
I watched an interview that you did with Brian Lamb just recently talking about this book and the entire project, and you said something that I thought, and said a number of things I thought were interesting, but said something to the effect of that you had felt that maybe there could be no better way to understand America than to explore the life of this man. How is it that you think understanding Roosevelt and looking at his life helps you understand this country?
Well, he embodied his country, and he embodied his time. And I use the word embody in the physical sense as well as the human sense. He just was so quintessentially American that, for me, as an immigrant here in the early 1970s, to choose a subject like Theodore Roosevelt was a self-education in my adopted country.
Mm. Something else that you said that also struck me, that you said that as a biographer, you really can't do the job unless you can get to the point where you can understand, imagine, feel what it would be like to actually be with that person, to have them there in the room with you. What if you could, if we could sit down today, if we could sit down with Theodore Roosevelt and spend time with him, what impressions would we get? What would it be like?
Well, I hesitate to hallucinate him, but he had such an overpowering impact on all those who came into his presence. Edith Wharton, for example, wrote after he died that the memory of every encounter with him was like a tiny morsel of radium blowing inside her. That this impact was so visceral, was so immediate and so strong, that everybody who memorialized him, who wrote about him, described him in such detail that a biographer looking at these documents a century later can feel his presence almost palpably. He was a physical marvel for a start. He was gifted with superabundant energy. He moved and thought and spoke that much quicker than ordinary people. And he discharged his personality with such voltage that that it's he's a biographer's gift, really. It's so easy in one way to write about somebody who was so very much palpably there. I think if he was reconstituted right now and appeared on American television, he would burst every set in the country because he just gave off so much heat that the cool medium of television would probably not be able to contain him.
Mm-hmm. And the story, maybe people are familiar with the story, that he had, particularly when he was younger, he did have health problems, and he was advised to that he would be advised to lead a quiet life, the life of a scholar, perhaps, and that he said, well, that's fine, but that's not what I'm going to do, and that he lived his life to the fullest, was certainly very physically active, and that was something that he maintained almost to the end of his life.
Yes, that's quite true. The doctor you're referring to was his doctor at Harvard, who, on the day that he graduated, told him to lead a sedentary life. And T.R. more or less did exactly what the doctor told him not to. He climbed mountains, he went west and punched cattle, and he chased women, which is to say he chased two women and married them both. And he went into a variety of professions, including becoming a soldier in 1898 and charging up San Juan Hill. So by the time he reached his later years, which I describe in Colonel Roosevelt, he was generally accepted to be a marvel of active energy. But that energy did burn itself out, and he died more or less on schedule, as he always said he would, at the age of 60.
He certainly, we have this picture of him as being this very robust, outgoing man of action, which he certainly was. I think, though, that when you look particularly at this time of his life, it shows you a different facet, a different TR, someone who has quite a considerable quality of mind. The man was an intellectual. He spoke a number of languages. He apparently had a stunningly clear and powerful memory, and maybe those sorts of things are not things that we immediately think of as being qualities of this man.
No, you're right. It's an unfortunate thing that the caricature of T.R. As a Western cowboy and a rough rider tends to obscure the fact that he was a bona fide intellectual, as you say. And I myself, having written about his youth and his presidency, was not fully aware of just how deep his intellect was compared to the breadth that I'd always been aware of before. The fact that he effortlessly encompassed so many disciplines, science and politics and literature and ornithology and history, all these aspects of him illustrated his breadth, as did his extraordinarily wide travels. But the depth of his mind did not make itself clear to me until I began to read the essays that he wrote after he left the presidency, mainly for a serious magazine called The Outlook, some of which were quite astonishing in their erudition, their grasp of writing in many languages on many subjects. So one of the delights of writing this book has been to be able to do full justice to Theodore Roosevelt the intellectual, in contrast to Theodore Roosevelt the politician.
Mm-hmm. It seems to me to be something of an injustice that, particularly if you look at the way that he's been portrayed in popular culture, that the outsized aspects of his personality are emphasized, and that these others are really downplayed to the point where, sadly enough, I think that sometimes he comes off almost a little buffoonish, which seems to me to be a great injustice to this man.
It is, but it's a lot of men of enormous historical stature that the more celebrated aspects of them, which are usually those which are most caricatured, do tend to live in memory. After his death, he was commonly perceived as our third greatest president after Washington and Lincoln. But in 1930, a journalist called Henry Pringle wrote a brilliant biography of him, which presented exactly the caricature image you've just described. And that book was so well written, even though it was very superficial in many respects, that his reputation took a real tumble and really did not begin to start climbing again seriously until the 1970s. But now, all these years after his death, he's more or less generally perceived by serious historians across the country in all the latest polls as the fourth amongst our five great presidents, after Lincoln and Washington and Franklin Roosevelt, his fifth cousin, who himself often said that Cousin Teddy was the greatest man he ever knew.
Our guest in this hour of Focus is Edmund Morris. He has written now three books about the life of Theodore Roosevelt, covering his life before the presidency, during the presidency, and after. And the new book has just recently come out. The title is Colonel Roosevelt. It is published by Random House, so you can certainly find it in the bookstore. Questions are welcome, 333-9455, toll-free, 800-222-9455, email will-talk@illinois.edu. And the title of this book, maybe we should explain, refers to the fact that after he was president, that's what Mr. Roosevelt wanted to be called.
Yes, after he left the White House, newsmen began to address him as Mr. President, which is traditional, but he protested at saying, "I am not president anymore. William Howard Taft is president. And I regard the title as being something temporary that is a gift to the people and has to be given back to the people." So they said, "Well, what do we call you?" And he said, "Well, I think you could call me Colonel Roosevelt, since I was a bona fide colonel in the Spanish-American War, and I earned my title through action, and it's mine for life." So for the rest of his 10 years after the White House, he was universally referred to as Colonel Roosevelt and addressed as Colonel.
When he was completing his second term, at that time, there would have been nothing other than tradition to prevent him from running for a third term, and it seems likely that if he had, he would have been elected again. Why was it that he decided to, at that point, to stop after having served two terms?
He simply said that he felt that the precedent established by George Washington of just two terms was enough for any man. And you're right in saying he could have had another term on a silver platter if he'd wanted. In fact, he could have had a fourth and a fifth if his popularity had continued the way it was. But I think in a genuinely noble gesture, he decided in 1908 to decline a third term, to hand over power to William Howard Taft, his hand-picked successor, and to go into retirement and live a life of literary production. But for complex reasons, he found within a year or so that he was beginning to hanker for the power that he'd given up, largely because Taft was compromising his record, particularly the conservationist record, of which he was very proud. And for that and a number of other reasons, he reluctantly ran for the presidency again in 1912.
And I think that it's certainly the case that it wasn't long after he left the White House that people started to miss him, and as you say, in large part because the judgment of Taft was that he was not a particularly great president. So perhaps it was some combination of his feeling that he wanted to be in the game again, and also there were an awful lot of people who were very happy with the idea of him coming back and running again.
Oh, absolutely. The media in particular, they loved him because he was such good copy, whereas Taft was kind of dull. But T.R. was so eccentric and so flamboyant and was such a master of handling the press himself that the press missed him when he went off to Africa. Almost as much as the American people. So when he came back from darkest Africa, which really was darkest Africa in those days, he was on safari for a year after the presidency. Within 3 weeks after leaving the White House, he was sitting on the cowcatcher of a train going up from Mombasa onto the Central Plains, and for the next year he was completely out of touch with the outside world. On safari, so when he emerged at Khartoum in the spring of 1910, he found that his absence had made him even more famous than he was before, the drama of his sudden disappearance. He'd become literally the most famous man in the world, and there was already a huge constituency back in the United States of so-called progressives, with a small p, Republican progressives mostly, who were hoping that he would come back and run again for the presidency.
I'd like to have you talk a little bit more about this year that he was in Africa, which is a remarkable story in and of itself. This was an enormous undertaking, involved a lot of people. What was the reason for going on this trip?
On the safari trip?
On the safari trip. Yeah.
Yes. Well, he wanted to absent himself from the American political scene. To be fair to President Taft, he understood that his personality was so galvanic, so distracting, that President Taft would have a very hard time of it, carving out an individual profile if TR was still in the country. So he deliberately disappeared into the wilds of Africa to let Taft build an independent profile. And it was, I think, also in the knowledge that there was a movement, a desire to have him return to politics when he got back from Africa, and he really rather hoped that desire would damp down during his absence. But on the contrary, it heated up.
And the trip itself was billed as a research effort. Certainly, a lot of specimens, and that means dead animals, were sent back to the United States to be mounted and went to various museums. And this, again, I think is something that now perhaps it's difficult for people to understand, particularly when you take into account, as you have his status as a conservationist, how it is that one could genuinely be interested in conservation and yet kill so many animals.
Well, I'm as bewildered as you are, if not more so. I've been studying him 30 years, and I cannot figure out how somebody who loved animals and birds so passionately, in fact, all of nature, his nature writings are his best prose. He had an absolutely Lorentzian, I'm thinking of D.H. Lawrence, Lorentzian ability to identify with all living things and describe them meticulously and exude love for them. But at the same time, this lover of nature, this genuine pantheist, took visceral delight in killing large animals, in hunting. It was a scientific expedition, the safari, as you said. And in fact, I bumped into a paleontologist the other day who said that some of the crates from that safari are still unopened. But although the safari was scientific in its purpose, you can't read his accounts of his lion hunts and the time he shot an elephant charging directly at him, and how afterwards he squatted down and ate chunks of the elephant's heart toasted over a fire with all his porters around him. You can't help feeling the bloodlust and the delight in killing, which is certainly incomprehensible to me. But let's face it, that the instinct to hunt and kill is as old as human beings are. And I must say, it gave me something of a shock when I looked at his safari diary and saw drawings, outline drawings of all the animals he killed, page after page. Every animal he shot, he drew it in outline. And these figures, which are rather gracefully drawn, in profile with the limbs and tails drifting off into white paper, are uncannily, and I think unconsciously, reminiscent of the drawings that Paleolithic man painted on the walls of caves. So we're dealing here, I suppose, with one of the basic human instincts, and the biographer just has to try and understand it.
Yeah. I suppose one also has to allow that at the time there were people who genuinely felt that killing animals and preserving them and mounting them and putting them in museums was a legitimate way to preserve them and give people a chance to see them, because this was, after all, there was no nature channel at that time. Very few people would be able to go to Africa on safari, but some people made the argument that at least gives the people a chance to see what these animals look like, if only in by going and seeing them behind a piece of glass in a museum.
That's true, but we still have hunter-collectors in our own day. Mm. I made a speech similar to the one I just gave you in Texas just a few days ago to a bunch of robust Republicans. I sensed from the quietness of their reception of my remarks about TR's hunting that they were all hunters themselves, and they thought there was something effeminate about a person who confessed that he didn't understand it and found it repulsive. To put TR in proportion, amongst gentlemen hunters of his time, he was no great shakes. He usually hunted for scientific purpose. And when you compare his tally in that year-long African safari, I think it was something like 282 specimens, with the 50,000 live animals that the Emperor of Austria killed in his lifetime, it sort of puts him in proportion.
Yeah. Just recently, I had been reading a book about the royals of the European royals of the late 19th century, and it would seem that people would think nothing of going out on a day and shooting thousands of birds in a single day.
Absolutely right, and Emperor Franz Joseph was an example of that. Mm. It's that indeed is beyond modern comprehension.
Our guest in this hour of Focus is Edmund Morris, and again, we're talking about the life of Theodore Roosevelt. He has written now three books, a trilogy about the life of Theodore Roosevelt. The third book now just has come out, and it covers the last 10 years of his life, that is his period, the period of his life after leaving the White House. The title of the book is Colonel Roosevelt, and it's published by Random House. And questions are welcome, 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455, email will-talk@illinois.edu. We have a caller here in Champaign County, here where we are. This is line one. Hello.
Hi. Just as an aside, sort of on the subject you were just talking about, I remember learning on this show that Audubon was actually a crack shot. He shot and then mounted his birds, so they weren't really life studies. They were not life studies. But I was moved to talk about. You mentioned earlier at the outset that conservation was a big impulse for his wanting to run again. But what I recall is that he was agitating people about the trust busting, and that was perhaps the most important motivation. Maybe was a motivation for the voters, not so much for him. I don't know what the record actually showed on how much trust busting he did. I think he did some, but compared to what the concentration of wealth was at the time.
You're quite right. In fact, that probably was even more important than what Taft was doing to his conservation record. It was a fundamental part of TR's ideology as president, so-called trust-busting, by which we mean regulation of giant corporations by strong executive government. That was his initial passion when he stepped in as president in 1901, and most of his first term was devoted to that ideology. He very flamboyantly prosecuted the second biggest trust in the world, the Northern Securities Company, in 1902. And he won a smashing victory in the Supreme Court and felt that he had vindicated the principle he was trying to establish, which is that of the necessity of regulation of great corporations. But oddly enough, after that, his corporate philosophy was quite moderate. He felt that he'd established a moral principle with the Northern Securities case. So for the rest of his presidency, he didn't initiate many more antitrust prosecutions. Ironically, President Taft prosecuted many more trusts than TR did, even though he was regarded as a conservative president in comparison. TR's conservation philosophy came into full flower in his second term, and he devoted most of his second term to that. And by the way, you're quite right about Audubon. I was shocked myself to discover that Audubon was more than just he shot more than just specimens for his collection. He liked to hunt and he liked to kill.
Well, I grew up hunting myself in a small town. I wasn't a very good shot because my vision was so bad, I didn't know. The other thing you said at the beginning was that you didn't want to hallucinate any conversations with him, but the one I'd like to hear is he and this is obviously tongue-in-cheek, the one with his photographer at San Juan Hill, because my understanding of the circumstance was that there was really no charge of the hill by he and his cronies at the time. They were sort of gentlemen soldiers, the Buffalo soldiers who had honed their fighting skills. A lot of them were minorities, fighting the Indians, had already pretty much taken the place. And it was sort of just a triumphant march by the general up the hill with the photo op, which he was apparently fairly already pretty astute at understanding the importance of producing his image. But,
I must respectfully differ with that. I think what you're saying ties in with this caricature that has arisen about him. In the first place, the story of the charge of the heights of San Juan, it was not San Juan Hill. The story of the charge up the heights of San Juan is quite complex. There was a regiment of black soldiers who performed heroically and charged more or less in the same direction up the same heights. The precise hill that T.R. captured with his Rough Riders, and very heroically too, was called Kettle Hill. Kettle Hill was a particular eminence on San Juan Heights. So he and the Black Regiment, his regiment and the Black Regiment, took the heights together, but T.R.'s particular feat was to charge up and capture the gun location at the top of Kettle Hill. And by all accounts, official accounts, his behavior was heroic. He campaigned in rather undignified fashion, in my opinion, for a Medal of Honor, which he felt he deserved. And although the accounts, the eyewitness accounts of his bravery are beyond question, the fact is that in that particular war, qualification for the Medal of Honor was set extremely high, so very few soldiers won it in that battle. And when President Clinton posthumously decided to give that medal to T.R., partly because of the lobbying by his family, I personally disapproved of that, because I thought that it was unfair to other soldiers who behaved with equal heroism, who should have qualified for it too.
Well, I want to thank the caller and go on to a couple of others. Just very quickly, maybe to underscore the point that you made, and the caller suggests that when he, after spending his year in Africa and then doing some traveling in Europe, he comes back to the United States, he became closely associated. He certainly was associated before, but perhaps even became more associated with the progressive movement and its agenda here in this country. And I think anti-corporatism is part of that. That seemed really to be, as you say, perhaps maybe the most powerful force that pulled him back into politics, and he becomes very closely identified with that.
Yes, the Progressive Party platform was extremely rich in reforms and anti-corporatism. I wouldn't quite use that phrase. The regulatory philosophy. He was not anti-corporations, but he did think that they should be subject to the supreme power of the government and not left to develop beyond control. At least trust control policies were a large part of the progressive agenda, but a lot of it was to do with legislation and reforms in behalf of the middle class and the working class, who felt themselves excluded from the privileged establishmentarian government of President Taft. Healthcare legislation, child labor laws, employer liability protections, and many other reforms of that kind, which were pretty radical for their time, particularly one which proposed a popular recall of unconstitutional judicial decisions. These proposals, many of them were so radical that they were actually not enacted until the administration of Franklin Roosevelt in the 1930s.
Let us continue to talk with people who are listening, and we'll go next to someone in Indiana, Muncie, Indiana. That's line four.
Hello.
Yes.
I'm wondering about his relationship to concepts like colonialism and manifest destiny and Cuba and the Philippines. Could you talk about that to some extent?
Yes, I could. He was a full-blooded imperialist when he was young, at the time of in the late 1890s, the time of the Spanish-American War. But he matured very rapidly and moderated as soon as he became president. He couldn't wait to give Cuba its independence, which he did in 1902. And he soon found that the Philippines insurrection, which was dragging on, this war that President McKinley had brought about, was dragging on to the embarrassment of the United States. And he saw that it was going to be impossible to impose the United States Constitution on the Philippines within the space of his presidency. So he disentangled himself from the Philippines as fast as he could and gave them a limited amount of self-government in, I think, 1906. And he always prided himself that during his presidency, the territory of the United States worldwide actually diminished in size. It's not to say that he didn't remain conscious of the fact that the civilization that he thought that he represented, which is Anglo-Saxon white civilization, was superior to other civilizations. And even into his later years, he maintained that belief. But it was moderated by an attitude toward race, which is a very complex subject that I can't get into in too much detail now. But, for example, when he was in Africa on that safari in 1909, and was feted by the colonial authorities in Nairobi, he gave a very moving speech that I discovered in the East African Standard newspaper, telling the white British colonials to be careful that they did not treat the black man with contempt as an inferior species, because that was incompatible with the ideals of democratic civilization. So he's a man who moderated in his lifetime, but nevertheless represented the prejudices of his generation.
One of the things that I think about him, I think, is interesting. At a time when people in Europe, at least, were fairly withering also in their contempt that they expressed for people in East Asia. And this was at a time when Japan was rising as a world power, and there was a lot of jockeying for power in Asia, involving Germany and Britain and Russia and other countries, that he seemed to hold the Japanese, at least, in fairly high regard.
Yes, you made a very good point. I should have thought of saying that myself, but I didn't. He regarded the Japanese race, and he used the word race, as fully equal to the Anglo-Saxon, largely because they'd shown such martial prowess in humiliating the Russian Empire in the Russo-Japanese War, and also for the quality of their civilization, the sophistication of their culture. So he admired the Japanese profoundly, whereas he felt that other races, as he called them, the Russian race, for being an example, as being decadent and on the way down.
Yeah.
We have to understand that the word race to Theodore Roosevelt was different from what we understand it. He tended to use in the sense of nationality.
And just quickly, worth noting, I think if this is something that people aren't aware of, that he was involved in negotiating the peace after the Russo-Japanese War, and he was, for that, he was awarded the Nobel Peace Prize.
Yeah, the first American ever to get that prize, and indeed the only president who's ever been asked to mediate a foreign war.
All right, let's talk with another caller here. This is someone in Urbana, where we are, line number two. Hello.
Yes, I'd like to go back to the trust busting. I think you're quite right that he more or less abandoned trust busting after the first few years in office. But then there was a shift to regulation and the use of commissions, which was more successful, in fact, and which remained very important right down to the, well, I would like to blame Reagan, but deregulation had actually started before that in the 70s.
Mm.
But it was a very important factor in our economy right down to the Reagan administration, and the deregulation that followed that and continued with Clinton had much to do with our present economic woes.
Yes, yes, indeed. Regulation by commission was a cardinal precept of the political Progressive Party platform in 1912. And one of the reasons T.R. seems so modern a figure right now is that his philosophy of regulation has become fraught once again with all the financial consequences of the deregulation that we experienced in the late 80s and 90s. So that particular issue, the issue of government regulation of corporations, which allowed full liberty, become quite amoral, is is exemplified in the Wall Street scandals of last year. It's as hot an issue now as it was in 1901.
Probably not. It was a very important issue, not only with Roosevelt, but also with his rival, Robert La Follette, and that branch of the progressives.
Yes. Yes, La Follette was really the original progressive. As a governor in Wisconsin in the early 20th century. I think T.R.'s antitrust philosophy was much more sophisticated than La Follette's because, or should I say, much more moderate. La Follette was very insular in his policies, very Midwestern and regionalist, but T.R. was much more of a cosmopolitan who understood the larger national scene.
Yes, Roosevelt was, I think we have to understand him as a very complex and often contradictory personality. Not alone in that. Jefferson also could be said to have been, in many respects, contradictory, but a fascinating character at any rate. Thank you.
Well, thank you for the call. I do think that it's interesting that it seems that now at this point that conservative political commentators in this country have been criticizing Theodore Roosevelt. One is sort of used to criticism of Franklin Roosevelt, but that they actually have reached back even further and really taken issue with T.R. and some of the things that he did when he was the president.
Well, if T.R. was alive now, he would be an activist Democrat. He believed in a strong central government and in control of big business and in fairly liberal social legislation.
Our guest in this hour of Focus, Edmund Morris, he has been writing about Theodore Roosevelt for decades now, several decades. He's authored three books that cover Roosevelt's life. The first, The Rise of Theodore Roosevelt, was about his years before he became president. That book received a Pulitzer Prize. Then after that was Theodore Rex, about his time in the White House. And then now he's authored the book Colonel Roosevelt, and this covers the last 10 years of Roosevelt's life from leaving the White House to his death. And it's just out now. It's published by Random House. Questions are welcome. 333-9455. Toll free, 800-222-9455. You can also send along your questions to will-talk@illinois.edu. And here's another caller, someone in Champaign. It's line one. Hello.
good morning. Yeah. Professor Morris, our book club read some years ago a fascinating book entitled The River of Doubt, Theodore Roosevelt's Darkest Journey, and I'm sure you're familiar with it, but it was absolutely fascinating to read about how Theodore Roosevelt and I believe his son journeyed on the Amazon. I don't recall, however, exactly when that took place. Do you?
Yes, I devote two chapters to that expedition. It occurred in the first 4 months of 1914.
Perhaps you might talk, Mr. Morris, talk some more about that, because it is another remarkable story and a case where it was a very difficult, very dangerous, very challenging trip, and in fact, life-threatening for Roosevelt.
Yes, it was. He left the United States after Woodrow Wilson's election, or at least after Wilson took power in the spring of 1914. That fall, he went down to Brazil to pursue a scientific expedition in behalf of the American Museum of Natural History. But when he was there, when he arrived in Rio de Janeiro, the Brazilian government persuaded him to undertake a different expedition in cooperation with their own men. What they wanted him to do was to explore an unknown river, the Rio da Duvida, the River of Doubt, which was thought to be a tributary of the Amazon. And they said that if he would consent to lead this expedition in partnership with a Brazilian officer, Colonel Candido Rondon, that they would provide financing and it would be a joint American-Brazilian expedition to put this this river on the map. So he found this invitation to be irresistible with his love of adventure and embarked on this gigantic expedition, which, as you said, brought him to the point of death because it turned out to be extraordinarily arduous. The river was longer than the Rhine. It, in fact, did turn out to be a tributary of the Amazon, and they did put it on the map, but in the course of the expedition, he suffered injuries combined with malnutrition, which affected everybody. Injuries so extreme that he reached the point of death one night, and in his delirium, he begged his son, Kermit, who was his partner in the expedition, to leave him to die and lead the other people to safety. Of course, they would not leave him, and he did recover. There's a picture in my book of him standing looking like a skeleton in the lower reaches of the river, as Colonel Rondon named the river in his honor, changing the name from the River of Doubt to Rio Roosevelt, or as the Brazilians now call it, Rio Teodoro, Theodore's River. And although he was triumphant in having put this river on the map, it very nearly killed him, and in fact, the toxins that were left in his system from malaria and abscesses and the heart trouble that he began to experience on the river, these medical factors contributed to his death on January the 6th, 1919.
I think that there are some people, in fact, in looking at this story and he is taking this trip, have almost suggested that perhaps they thought he had a death wish.
Oh, no, no. If he had, well, let me say this. He certainly expected the expedition to be much less arduous than it was. But if he showed any inclination towards a death wish, it was only in his romanticization of the notion of a glorious death in battle. And that became pretty apparent after he got back from the River of Doubt in the middle of 1914 when the war had broken out in Europe. And within a year, T.R. was an ardent advocate of American participation in that war and began to conceive of the notion of a regiment, a division of American volunteers to be sent to the front to fight on the side of France and Britain against German militarism, a division led by himself. And it was quite apparent in this dream, that, as he enunciated it, that he would not at all mind if he died gloriously in that battle.
I think, though, that one of the things that you argue perhaps contributed to his death and might well have led him to re-examine his feelings about war and about being in battle was the death in World War I of his youngest son.
Yeah, that was the major irony of his life, and I think the major tragedy of his life. He was, after the United States decided in the spring of 1917 to enter the war, Woodrow Wilson declared war eventually. That's when T.R.'s desire to lead this division became at its sharpest, and he went to Washington and almost on his knees begged Woodrow Wilson to be allowed to lead this division to the war. And when Woodrow Wilson denied him that privilege for pretty reasonable reasons, the fact that he was 58 years old and the art of war had changed since he was charging up the heights of San Juan, T.R. put all his frustrated desires for military glory onto the shoulders of his four sons. And the irony was that the least martial of those four boys, they all went to the war, Quentin, the youngest, the one most like himself, was the one who got killed. He was shot down as a fighter pilot in July of 1918. And the shock of his death, the tragedy of it, and the purposelessness of it affected his father so dramatically that it was more or less foreordained that T.R. would himself die a few months later of a broken heart.
There is one other story. I realize we're jumping back in time, and this is much a different kind of story, but I like it so much, and it seems to fit so much with the image that we have of him. And I'm thinking of the story of his of the attempt on his life when he was running for president, and this was in 1912 that he was shot, and rather than go to the hospital, he went on to give the speech that he was scheduled to give.
Yes, it was an assassination attempt on Kennedy, like the one on Ronald Reagan in March of 1981, coming out of a hotel, bullet in the chest as he climbed into his limousine, and joking with the doctors when he finally did get to the hospital. But as you say, he insisted on delivering the speech that he had ready in the Milwaukee Auditorium. He spoke for 90 minutes with blood spreading across his shirt front, and he shouted out, "It takes more than this to kill a bull moose." In a splendid display, a melodramatic display of macho quasi-heroism, which of course shocked the audience and won him a large sympathy vote, although he was in fact defeated in the subsequent election.
Yeah. I think as you do, it's no doubt worth making the point that in fact in that election, even though Woodrow Wilson won, Roosevelt came in second. And if he, I think the feeling is that if he had been the candidate of the Republican Party and not had, and the vote had not been split, he likely would have won.
I don't think so. It was a formidable candidacy, mm-hmm. and he did humiliate Taft by getting many more votes than the sitting president. But the way things were stacking up, it was quite obvious that the Democratic Party was on its way back in a big way. And it's, I don't think, even if he had been the Republican nominee, the GOP might have swung that election. It overwhelmingly went to the Democratic Party. Mm. But it's certainly true that in 1920, if he'd lived that long, he would have been renominated by the GOP, and without question he would have been elected, reelected, in the Republican landslide that gave us President Harding.
Well, we are going to have to stop. Sorry to say, one could talk much more and at greater length. For people who would like to read about the life of Theodore Roosevelt, you should go and look at these books that we've been talking about now, three volumes covering the life of Roosevelt, The Rise of Theodore Roosevelt, Theodore Rex, and the third and latest, Colonel Roosevelt. It's about the last 10 years of Theodore Roosevelt's life. It's published by Random House by our guest Edmund Morris. Also, I would like to just get in a plug here for your wife, Sylvia Jukes Morris, who has written an interesting book about Roosevelt's second wife, Edith Kermit Roosevelt. So that's also an opportunity for people to read something more about the Roosevelts.
Yeah, that continues
Thank you very much for being with us. We certainly appreciate it.
All right. Thanks a lot.
Support for today's broadcast comes from Escobar's Restaurant on Columbia Avenue in downtown Champaign. Open Tuesday through Sunday for lunch, dinner, and Sunday brunch. Serving a Nuevo Latino cuisine in a relaxed, casual atmosphere. Menus and reservation information available online at escobarsrestaurant.com.
You've been listening to a program from the Focus Archives. Many of our past shows, along with local news features, are available on our website. Anytime that you're ready to listen, just go to will.illinois.edu. At this point, we'll take our usual break for news, and then Focus will continue, so please stay tuned.
Agricultural information on WILL is made possible with support from ADM. ADM thanks America's farmers, because everything they do starts with you.
Good morning, everyone. This is Dave Dickey with a look at the commodity markets, where at mid-session, front-month corn futures on the Board of Trade are extending the advances that they saw yesterday and hovering and nearing $6.50 a bushel on follow-through buying after yesterday's USDA data forecast tighter-than-expected U.S. corn supplies, a drop in the U.S. dollar is also providing some underlying support at mid-session. Let's look at particulars, and we'll go ahead and begin in the corn pit, where March is now 6.48, up 17, May 6.57, up 17 and a quarter, now up 17.